coming up on Philosophy Talk.
I think we have to understand war as an historically changing human institution.
Does fighting a war require demonizing the enemy?
Who is the enemy? Everyone keeps asking. Where and who is the enemy?
Isn't the enemy just a construction of the government and the media?
Nations don't come as unified wholes anymore. Nations are internally heterogeneous. They have shifting boundaries. I mean, I'm not sure the enemy is a single character or a single nation.
War, sacrifice, and the media.
Our guest is Judith Butler, author of Frames of War, When is Life Grievable?
Do I only grieve for those who are recognizably like me? Or can I also grieve for those who are in some ways not like me? Who I've never met, whose names I don't even have?
Recorded in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
War, Sacrifice, and the Media. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we've taken Philosophy Talk just down the road. We're recording the program in front of a live audience at the Marsh, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
So we're very happy to meet in person some of our listeners right here in San Francisco. Folks, welcome to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is war, sacrifice, and the media.
Ken, you know, whenever America's involved in a war in a distant land, at the same time we're involved in another war closer to home. And the second war isn't fought with tanks or bombs or missiles, but with ideas, words, and images.
You're thinking of the struggle over the narration and representation of war, its meaning, its cost and benefits, its victors and vanquished, its combatants and non-combatants. You know, he or she who controls the narration and representation of war controls the public perception of war.
Well, Ken, I've been through a lot of wars. World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and all these wars we've been having recently. And I think it's pretty obvious who controls what is represented and how it's represented, and that's the elites. The political elites, the moneyed elites, the media elites. The war comes at us through a top-down system of politically, economically, and culturally conditioned representations that are designed to make us feel sympathy for our own side and antipathy, indifference, hate for the other side.
Gosh, John, you're probably right about that, but the so-called elite, of which you and I are card-carrying members, by the way, doesn't always speak with a unified voice. And top-down efforts to control thought and manipulate sympathy through mass representations hardly ever succeeds, at least not in a fractious and boisterous democracy like ours, and at least not in the long run.
Well, a long run can be pretty long. I mean, eventually McNamara dies and things return to normal, but it takes quite a while. Maybe in the age of the internet, things can happen a little bit quicker. People do have access to alternative sources of information that offer a different take on things. Even the most repressive and controlling regimes can't keep competing narratives completely out of the public square.
You're certainly right about that. Think of those brave Iranian students tweeting on the barricades.
Still, it would be a serious mistake to underestimate them, the power of the top-down narration. Remember the early days of the Afghanistan War and then the Iraq War. The so-called mainstream media, even the New York Times, bent over backwards to tell the story of the war in terms pretty much dictated by the administration military. It was disgusting. There were dissenting voices, but they were pushed pretty far off stage.
You're right, but there's a deeper question. I mean, we talked about different narratives, but here's a question. Are different narratives, are they just different, or is it possible for one to be true and the other to be false? And how do we go about determining, how do we citizens go about determining which is true and which is false? And who should determine what gets represented and how it gets represented?
Well, Ken, of course the narratives can be true or false, more, at least more true to the facts and less true to the facts. For example, a narrative of the Iraq War that focuses only on the casualties on our side and leaves out the death and displacement we impose on the innocent citizens of that poor country is incomplete and untrue to the facts. Can you have any question about that?
Well, no, but, you know, there is this thing. Our narratives are bound to be incomplete. You know, because they're always constructed from a particular and partisan point of view. It's just a fact that in war, it's just a fact, the lives of enemy combatants count less than the lives of our own soldiers. And it follows from that fact that our narratives of war are bound to privilege the lives and losses of our own and de-emphasize, de-privilege, if you will, the lives and losses of the distant other.
Well, it may be a fact, but it's not a good fact. It's not a good thing. It's a bad thing if we're blind to the common humanity we share with our adversary.
It's a human thing. We're sort of biologically programmed, I think, to care more about those who are near and dear and less about the distant other.
But biology is not destiny. Whatever we're biologically programmed to do, morally we ought to care about human beings wherever they are, all equally.
That sounds nice, John, but where would such oughts come from? I mean, if it's really true that humans are hardwired to care more about the near and dear than the distant other, I mean, is it even possible for us to treat all humans everywhere as equally worthy of respect and sympathy? I mean, if it's not possible, what makes it the case that we ought to do that?
Well, if the reach of human sympathy was just a product of unaided biology, we probably couldn't have sympathy beyond the bounds of our family or our local tribes. Some progress has been made. It's also shaped by culture, society, and politics. And in the right sort of political, social, cultural context, we could have equal regard for the lives of innocent victims of war everywhere.
Again, that sounds really nice. I hope you're right. But, you know, it's hard to imagine, I confess, how we get from where we are to where you think we ought to be.
Well, we're going to be joined by someone who can help us figure that out. Our guest is Judith Butler. She's the author of Frames of War, When is Life Grievable? She'll help us to understand the complex social and political dynamics that shape our dehumanizing representation and narration of war. She'll also help us to imagine how more humanizing narratives might be accepted by the public.
We also want help from our live audience here at the Marsh Theater. Get ready to join the conversation by stepping up to the microphones a little bit later in the program, folks.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Rena Palta, talks to a refugee from Iraq about life during wartime. She files this report.
Sawad Hussein grew up in Baghdad.
I was like a regular citizenship, doing whatever to get a living. I was work maintenance garage for cars, like washing cars, change oil, something like that. It's like for 5 or 7 years before the war.
On March 20th, 2003, American armed forces advanced into Iraq. And in a little over 2 weeks, ground and air troops had reached Baghdad.
The sound of battles and bombing is now coming from all directions. There are now no exit routes for escape, and with the blanket and smoke and the sandstorms, this just adds to the terror. There's no way to communicate with family and friends to find out if they're okay. Since the phones are out, you can't see anything. All you can hear is this constant thud, thud, thud.
When the war started, nobody able to go to work. Well, actually, no movement on the streets, and you need to work hard to get the money, so you don't have time to mourn or to be happy. You need to get work from all day long.
When American troops started settling into Baghdad and occupying old palaces and government buildings, Hussein says they also started hiring.
They need to clean whatever was there before, so we went to them and they were picking like 40 or 50 people a day.
Hussein knew English and got a job translating between soldiers and work crews. He says he loved working for the U.S. Army, but then militias started targeting people like him who worked for the Americans. Hussein says he found notes tacked on his door threatening his family. One time in 2006, Al-Qaeda came to his house. That's when he really started worrying.
I can't let my daughter to go to school over there, because if somebody knows that is my daughter, maybe she's going to be kidnapped. That's, you know, just to hurt me.
In 2009, Hussein moved his wife and two daughters to Oakland, part of a special program for Iraqi employees of the U.S. Armed Forces. He says the best part, besides getting his daughter back in school, is not having to worry about the latest news.
I just want to get off from the news for a little while. Because you're in Baghdad, you need to watch the news. Because, you know, tomorrow is like curfew, tomorrow is that road blocked, that road closed, you know, militias, vivids, like car bombs, whatever. So you got a headache from the news. So when you go out from Baghdad, even if you go like to Jordan and Syria, you want to forget about it. That's it. I have had it, you know?
Saddam Hussein's been through a lot since the war started, but that's not the message he wants to send to Americans.
I want them to know that, I mean, their sons did a great job over there. For me, I'm very thankful for them. Not because I'm here, but at least they released us from the other regime. But now maybe we got our own opinion, we got our own elections, you know, some big difference. So I just trying to thank them.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Rena Palta.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor.
And we're joined now by Judith Butler. She's professor of rhetoric and comparative literature at UC Berkeley. She's an internationally renowned thinker and scholar. She's author most recently of Frames of War, When is Life Grievable? Judith, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Judith, I think it's fair to say that you're best known for your work on gender and identity. But now you've gone and written a book about war and the representation of war. How did you get from gender and identity to war and the representation of war?
Well, I think I've been working on war and its representation since 2001. Many of us were forced to change directions at that point. But there is a direct link, and I think it comes from reflecting on what happened during the AIDS crisis in the United States. I should say the AIDS crisis continues many other places, but during the most severe years of the AIDS crisis in the U.S., there was, in general, a political effort on the part of the NAMES Project and a number of different organizations to openly grieve the losses of those who died from AIDS. And in order to openly grieve those losses, we had to really break through certain kinds of taboos, and we had to break through social shame. Open grieving became a really important political concept. After 2001, it became clear to me that there was lots of open grieving. In fact, we might even say histrionic grieving about certain people who died under certain circumstances, namely Americans, usually people who are legal, who were in the World Trade Center, and some in the Pentagon, but others who very quickly became victims of U.S. war efforts were not openly grieved and not, I would say, openly grievable. And that led me to ask the question, under what conditions can we grieve certain kinds of people? Under what conditions can we not?
Well, that's extremely interesting, the effort like of the New York Times to actually produce little obituaries for every single one of the people that died in the World Trade Center. I mean,
yes,
it was very impressive because it really gave us a sense of when somebody dies, it's not just statistics, it's a real life. But then that didn't happen with all the people that died in Iraq that were civilians. But now, is that peculiar to America's way of doing things? Are we particularly good or bad at representing our adversaries as less fully human and therefore less grievable than others? Or isn't that the way of war, the way it's always been? Like,
well,
Ken was saying, it's in our genes.
Hey, you know, if it's the way it's always been, it doesn't mean it's a good thing that it's always been that way. Okay, just to cite you back to yourself.
Right.
But in fact, I think it's not always that way. And I think we have very culturally specific ways of mourning. If you think about those obituaries in the New York Times, they were usually a photo, mm-hmm. and usually a story about someone who belonged to other people, either through family or work environments, who had dogs and who had great happiness and whose happiness was cut short by this sudden and horrible act of destruction. Now, in fact, a lot of those stories were made to seem a little happier than they actually were. We never really got obituaries for the people without legal papers who were in those buildings.
Right.
And there were apparently many.
Well, wait, okay.
And there were certain kinds of stories that couldn't be told.
I take your point. I want to think there's all kinds of people connected up in war, bound up, you know, the illegal immigrant and all that. But what about the enemy? I mean, doesn't every nation everywhere always not give full credence to the enemy and his or her losses? And
well, you know, I think we have to ask whether wars, as they're currently being waged, involve we, the nation state, and them, the enemy. I mean, I'm not sure the enemy is a single character or a single nation, especially with a network like Al-Qaeda. Like, who is the enemy? Everyone keeps asking, where and who is the enemy? It can cross national lines, can cross religious lines. I don't think we have a single...
So is that because... So you think, okay, the enemy has become sort of abstract and deconcretized or something?
That there are new ways of waging war. When we're waging war against a network, we're no longer waging war against a nation. I don't think we have a single figure of the enemy.
Well, I mean, it was something very peculiar about the narrative we were getting, because we were there in Iraq to free the Iraqi people from this tyrant. So why wouldn't, if that's why we were there, their lives must have been worth a lot, but why then weren't we allowed to know how many of them were dying and never have any representation of who they were?
Well, I think that's a key question, and I think we can also ask, at what time did the deposing of the tyrant become the reason we were in that war, right? Because that was kind of a late goal that was set. So that's one question. But it is true, we don't ever get a sense of what those lives are like and what the effect of our destructiveness really is.
This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco. We're discussing war, sacrifice, and the media with Judith Butler, author of Frames of War.
We've been talking about how nations and people, particularly Americans, deeply at odds with one another, represent each other. In our next segment, we'll talk about how they ought to represent and narrate their conflicts. Is it even possible, is it thinkable for warring nations to perceive, acknowledge, respect the common humanity across the divides? Or is that acknowledgement simply inconsistent with the inner logic of war?
Common humanity versus the logic of war, along with questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. Our topic is war, sacrifice, and the media. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Judith Butler, author of Frames of War, When is Life Grievable?
How ought warring people or nations to represent and narrate their conflict? Is it even possible for nations to acknowledge their common humanity while they're at war? Join in the conversation by stepping up to one of the microphones on either side of the stage.
So, Judith, I want to go. We were talking about this toward the end of the last segment. So it seems to me war has a kind of logic, right? The other side is the enemy. We want to kill the enemy. We're the good guys. They're the bad guys. I mean, there can be some limits. You know, the Holocaust was beyond the logic of war. But doesn't the inner logic of war somehow dictate to some extent how we see the other side and how they see us back?
I think we have to understand war as an historically changing human institution. So I'm not sure there's one inner logic to war.
Talk about that.
So, for instance, we might be at war against Iraq, but at a cultural level, it seems to me that the U.S., at least under the Bush regime, was really also engaged in a war against Islam. Now, what's the relationship between Islam and Iraq? A lot of people couldn't even tell you, or they couldn't understand, you know, what the different groups are, the different religious groups there. It seems to me that war has a way of displacing the enemy so that we think really we're against Iraq, but now we're against Islam, or we're against dissidents in the U.S. who criticize war. The object of war, even the object of hatred in war, has a way of changing over time.
A war against Islam, isn't that war run amok? I mean, because Islam is this complicated worldwide thing, right? Al-Qaeda is a local thing. Well, it's kind of global, but it's localized here and there. It's got a particular agenda. You can't say Al-Qaeda is Islam. I mean, that would be a complete... If we were at war against Islam, how could we be at war against Islam?
Well, I appreciate your rationality, and I wish people shared it. but as you know, it's just recent memory. I mean, many people said Al-Qaeda is not only the radical representation of Islamic extremism, but it is the logic of Islam brought to its logical extreme.
So, okay, I mean, I would think that a war against Islam, as a war of West against East or something, is just a craziness.
Yes.
It violates all kinds of canons of reasonableness. A war against a particular country might be a highly reasonable thing. And I'm wondering, I mean, if war hasn't run amok, isn't it still going to follow that we're going to devalue the enemy, right? I mean, not just in the case of something crazy like a war against Islam, right? I mean,
I don't know. Now I'm wishing you were a little more reasonable, because it seems to me that when you say a war against a nation might be a reasonable thing, but a war against a given religion would be an unreasonable thing. It seems to me with nations, as with religions, we're actually talking about abstractions, about an imagination of a unity. And in fact, nations don't come as unified wholes anymore. Nations are internally heterogeneous. They have shifting boundaries. I think we can unify the idea of the nation for the purposes of war, but I don't think we can presuppose an idea of the nation as a kind of reasonable enemy within war. I'm not sure that's true.
I think I take your point. I mean, if somebody were to declare against a war against the United States because, say, they, let's go back to the Ancien Regime, because they hated conservative policies and the attempt to spread democracy everywhere and all that stuff, and they declared war on the United States, for that reason, I mean, on certain grounds, I would be their ally, because I would say, I'm not a fan of conservative policies. I don't think we should be trying to be impose our way of life. So I would say, how could your war be a war against me? In a certain sense, I see your point. But somehow I can't escape the fact that I am of and in and allied to America, and that that those who object to America are objecting to the nation of which I am a member.
But let me put it to you a different way. Both the war against Afghanistan and Iraq started with the stated rationale that we were after al-Qaeda, and with the understanding that al-Qaeda was housed there, or that it was one of its locations, and with the understanding that al-Qaeda could not be identified with either nation.
I mean, something not very funny happened to war in the last 200 years. I mean, at the beginning of World War II, I think Roosevelt's quoted saying, well, you can't attack the civilian populations. By the end of World War II, everybody accepted what was, if they didn't call it terror bombing, what really was terror bombing. Churchill says, well, we're not really bombing the German people, we're just destroying their habitat so they can't work in the factories.
Right.
But that's a rather fine distinction. Then you have attempts to kind of distinguish, like in Vietnam and in Iraq, oh, we've got the people, we're there to help the people, right. We're just fighting the armed forces. But you can't make that stick.
No, you can't make it stick. And I think we saw another example of it in the recent assault on Gaza, which I don't think we can call a war, by the way. I mean, it was a violent assault, but I don't think we can call it a war, according to any standard definition of war, which then raises the question whether there's a logic to war. But even there, it seemed to me that any possible Gazan civilian was presumed to be a human shield, right? So we get the human shield argument actually right. Making the case that there are no neutral civilians.
Right. Well, I understand. I mean, you would think that's a reductio ad absurdum. Right, there are no neutral civilians, so everything is fair game. But okay, let me do my thing and play devil's advocate. Think of Hitler's Germany, that book, the Hitler's Willing Executioners. Think of all the cooperation from all the ordinary Germans that it took to pull off the Holocaust. Now, you might say, well, these are innocent civilians, but if you cooperate willingly, sort of knowingly, with this massive architecture of oppression and destruction, do you get to say, I'm not fair game because I merely, I don't know, go to the camp every day, or I work in the factory, or I, you know.
I should warn you, a guy got fired from the University of Colorado for using that same argument with respect to all the people that died in the World Trade Center.
I know.
That they were right. America's willing, what is it?
Willing executioners.
Willing executioners.
So what do you think of that kind of line? I mean, I'm not...
You know what? I actually don't think we can answer this question in the abstract. And I, what my real belief is that there are modes of resistance within civilian populations. There are zones of innocence as well. I think we would have to look at these very specific situations. We could also look at some very interesting histories of the German resistance, of people who actually really sought to undo right. that the machinery of fascism, right. And who were really important in hiding and saving minority populations, Jews and others who were in concentration camps. So, I think that we have to be very careful.
I think you're right. So, I mean, I don't deny that. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about war, sacrifice, and the media with our guest, Judith Butler, author of Frames of War, When is Life Grievable? We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance, and we've got questions from our live audience.
Hello, my name is Greg Slater. I would just like to ask, in discussing the degree to which it is even possible for the people of a nation to empathize with the people of a nation that their government is attacking, isn't it a large degree dependent upon the honesty of the claims that are used to justify the war in the case of Iraq? If a war is justified on complete lies, then the government is already committed to a deception which it will push at all costs, and therefore the possibility of the people being allowed to empathize with the people of another country is almost nil. So it puts the onus on the people to demand legitimate justification for war from their outset, or you will almost certainly end up with no possibility of any contact with the people.
Let me give a brief reaction to that before turning it over to Judith. I think lies is too simple. If you look at American history, you go back to the War of 1812. It's not lies, it's self-deception in Washington, D.C. I mean, it's people that convince themselves that the Canadians really want us to invade. And what would they have had to do to find out if that was true? Send someone and ask, because once the war started, somebody went to the border and said, we're at war with Britain, you can come over to our side now, and they said, no thanks. Right? In Vietnam, the fog of war. What a bunch of bull. There was no fog. All they had to do was go to George Washington University Library and read up on the places they were invading. It's self-deception. It's the idea that these jerks in the White House and in Congress have this ability to ferret out what's true and false. It's in a way, it's worse than lying.
Judith,
just my opinion.
What do you think?
Well, I appreciate that. I guess I want to go back to the idea of empathy for a moment, because it may seem that what I'm saying is that what we need to do is develop empathy for all kinds of people everywhere in the world. But I'm a little suspicious of empathy as a category that can help us right now, because usually with empathy, one has a certain model, already existing model, of who can be injured or who can be lost or whose life is worth grieving. And you take that image of the human being who qualifies as grievable and you project it onto someone else. And it may be that we actually need to allow our ideas of what the human is to become a little bit more flexible and actually acknowledge cultural difference. Now, acknowledging cultural difference seems to me very different from engaging in empathy. And it could be that we can extend respect and even mourning to those who are not like us or whose difference from us is not readily knowable or readily narratable. How would that look? Is that the same as empathy? I'm not sure.
But they seem, it's some kind of, I don't know if it's empathy, because that sounds emotional, right? Rooted in the sentiments. But it's some kind of acknowledgement. I mean, you might think of it as Kantian respect if you were prone to do such things, but it's some kind of attitudinal thing toward the other.
Yeah,
right?
I don't mind it being emotional. I mean, I actually do think we ought to be capable of greater grieving. So yeah. I don't mind that. But what I worry about is setting up an analogy. This other is like me. Well, yes and no. Yes and no. Do I only grieve for those who are recognizably like me? Or can I also grieve for those who are in some ways not like me, who I've never met, whose names I don't even have?
So let me crawl off my soapbox and ask a kind of semi-practical question. It's really a follow-up to your question. What would it look like? What would it look like if, say, the New York Times tried to do for the civilians in Iraq what it did for the civilians in the World Trade Center? There's a lot of good forces in the country. What can they do to engender how do we use the modern tools of the internet or Twitter or whatever, for God's sake, people are doing to do what you're calling on us to do?
Well, I think it's already happened in many cases. And I think one of the things that happened most importantly in Iraq was the breakdown of embedded reporting. Now, embedded reporting means that the pictures we get and the stories we receive are all from a certain perspective, are all from a certain point of view. And that point of view is one that the Department of Defense has approved of in advance,
right?
Okay? Now, when the camera strays or when a story emerges, maybe through the internet or through some less controlled media, it interrupts the perspective of war that embedded reporting institutes. So there are such interruptions. They happen all the time. The Abu Ghraib photos were such interruptions. I think, in fact, the Twitter from the Iranian front is a kind of interruption of dominant media in that way as well.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about war, sacrifice, and the media with Judith Butler. And we've got more questions from our live audience.
Hi, my name is Danny. When is an individual at war exactly? You know, we're talking about grieving and empathy, and that seems to be really almost said in a way that we all are grieving, or it's like a homogenous right. feeling among us. Is it when someone tells you that you are at war or that you are grieving that you become part of that, or is it something that you can do as an individual?
I have to tell you, I have to make a personal confession. I never felt like I was at war against Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt like I was a resistor. I still feel like I'm a resistor to that war. But somehow the nation of which I'm a member is at war, and I am a member. So that's a complicated thing, isn't it? I mean, Judith, help us.
Listen, I mean, I'm not sure you can resist your government being at war without, in some sense, being part of that war effort. One way of being part of a war effort, if we're all part of the war effort, is to resist it. I think that's possible. And I don't think what we need are more heroic individuals. It's not that the individual act is really the most important thing. It's networks of solidarity and collective actions that I think are most powerful.
We've got more questions on this side of the room.
Yes, my name is Larry. And I would like to just hark back just a little bit to the discussion about war with Islam or war with a nation, and then that the nation is harder to define, and there are shades here. I just recently read an article in The New Yorker, I think it was called The Kill Squad, but it dealt with soldiers going to war and meeting various definitions of what's out there. I think they were called rules of engagement, and depending how these were defined by superiors, it could include everybody in a particular area. And in some areas, something like free fire zones in Vietnam, where I engage with whomever I see. And in other areas, we have to distinguish between this person and that. How does a soldier deal with this really amorphous kind of situation where I may kill somebody and get a medal for it, or I may kill somebody and be convicted of murder, when how the victim is defined by somebody above me, and I'm supposed to have empathy with one group, and I go in there with my gun. I don't. I opted not to when I was young, but many people do. How do you deal with that in these days?
That's a tough question. Judith, if you've got any wisdom in that, tough one.
Well, I do think that there are soldiers who have, in the last year or so in Iraq, banded together to say that they don't have clear instructions and that there aren't clear rules of engagement and that they can't fight well or effectively under those conditions. In my view, that's a step in the right direction. Putting down the guns altogether and having a little velvet revolution would be even better.
But there's a kind of danger of, I mean, from the way you characterize it, there's a sign of a danger of self-collapse, self-refutation, right? Because it turns out that these categories that you have they're not coherent. And they're going to collapse upon themselves because they give to the soldier an instruction that he's at a C and trying to follow. So that's like the logic of war is an incoherent logic in that kind of situation.
Well, I think the logic of war is always an incoherent logic.
Well, you may be right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing war, sacrifice, and the media with Judith Butler, author of Frames of War, When is Life Grievable?
We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. In our next segment, we'll ask how we might get from where we are to a more inclusive, more humanizing narrative, a narrative that enables us to recognize and acknowledge the full humanity of both the enemy combatants and the innocent victims of war.
Rewriting our narratives of war, plus more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing war, sacrifice, and the media with Judith Butler, author of Frames of War, When is Life Grievable?
Judith, I don't think we'll ever be able to make war and conflict go away, at least not in my lifetime or what's left of it. But help us think about how we collectively might go about redoing our way of narrating war and conflict. Does all the new media help us in doing that? Could we restructure these narratives so we can still acknowledge the full humanity, even of our enemies?
I think it's probably a mistake to think of the internet as a radically free space. I think there's all kinds of regulation and even censorship on the internet that has to be thought about carefully. At the same time, it seems to me that there are ways for photos to travel, and there are ways for anecdotes to travel. There are ways for reports and analyses to travel that are not filtered through dominant media. And that strikes me as really important. I'm not sure, if we think about it, the release of the Abu Ghraib photos actually did turn the tide against the war. People actually started to ask whether we were involved in a just war.
And the dominant media, when it started to show what we were doing in Vietnam, despite their sucking up the power, was highly instrumental to turning the tide against the Vietnam War. I mean,
yes,
there's no doubt about that. But let me ask you a question. I mean, so when people see what is being done in their names, often they react with revulsion. I mean, that the optimist in me suggests that if we could just learn to see the other, whatever exactly that seeing consists in, I mean, war, I don't know if it would go away, but it'd be much harder to wage. What do you think? I mean, is it possible for us to fully see the other and but nonetheless say, I will kill you?
I don't know what it would mean fully to see the other. I think that's a really good question. Is it ever possible fully to see oneself, to make oneself seeable by another, or to even to see another in a full sense? I mean, those are large, good philosophical questions, but I'm not sure we have to answer them in order to oppose torture.
Well,
in any and all of its instances.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, for instance, we have a problem because those who were tortured in Abu Ghraib are protected by international law. Their privacy is protected by international law. We are not entitled to know their names necessarily. We are not entitled to interview them.
Is it supposed to protect them?
Well, it is supposed to protect them in the sense that it would be wrong to subject them to further exposure or to subject them to further exposure against their will. And let's remember, exposure to the camera against their will was part of the torture itself. So we're in a bind. Do we need to know them, see them, fully understand them in order to object to the fact that they're tortured? I don't think so. Could we even defend their privacy at the same time that we radically object to their torture? Yes, I think so.
We've got more questions from our live audience in this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
My name's Edward, and I'm interested in a recent encouraging development in Afghanistan, where the commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, General McChrystal, has ordered his commanders to limit airstrikes in support of American troop movements when those airstrikes might endanger civilian lives. And it seems to me like it's a politically risky thing to do, because I could imagine that Americans would see that as increasing the risk to U.S. troops. And I'm wondering, how is this happening? Is it sustainable, this sort of tactic? And do they feel like it's, safe to do this now, because there's been some kind of change in American perception of what's happening in Afghanistan and of the Afghan people?
Well, I think it's important to note that Obama came under pretty quick criticism in the opening months of his administration for certain strikes in Pakistan and Afghanistan that did take civilian tolls. And every time that happens, there is very strong public criticism of his administration. So it's a criticism that's moved from the Bush to the Obama administration, and that's, I think, getting stronger. My own view is really that, yes, of course, the more we see people at risk and the more we actually see that risk is shared on all sides, it seems to me the closer we move toward a cessation of hostilities.
A friend of mine, I was telling her about this program and what we were going to talk about, and she said, well, the problem with making all life grievable is that there's so much sadness, there's so much misery. Nietzsche has this quote in the Gay Science about, if you could see the history of human suffering, basically, you'd be paralyzed. But if you could Nonetheless, despite all that, go on. Like a soldier on the second day of battle that has brought him nothing but loss and sorrow, right? Then you could achieve a new humanity. But there's so much human suffering out there, right? If you took it all in, wouldn't you just be like, my friend says, debilitated? So we blind ourselves right to the other to save ourselves?
Well, I don't think we have to be wailing and weeping for every lost living being. You know, I think that would paralyze us, and I'm totally with Nietzsche there. But I think we could develop certain kinds of principles that are actually based on the acknowledgement of the worthiness of life or the grievability of life. And I use a big word like grievability because I'm really trying to say that these are lives that are worthy of being grieved, even if we are not the ones to grieve them. And I think that, that there's a difference there, and those are principles that are worth pursuing.
I mean, there is a there seems to be a difference in people between people who are simply moved to action or inaction by particular circumstances and imagining what it's like to be a particular person that's bombed or something, and people who are capable, as I don't think I would be, of being moved by very abstract, long-term considerations. I mean, Robert McNamara is represented as this anguished person who every day went in and realized we were losing the war in Vietnam and we were losing the population and was aware of all the casualties. But he had this image that it was very important that the dominoes be propped up and that in the long run, in the big calculus of things, it was better just to pursue the war. My own feeling is the only hope is to keep people like that away from the controls of power. It's nutty people who have real emotions that are geared to the wrong things that are the problem.
I understand your point, John, and I think it's well taken. But, you know, we're in a different world in a way. This is, I think, something we need to touch. So, Judith, you were talking about nations. In a way, I wouldn't say nations are obsolete, but they're becoming more and more less the locus of significant things. I mean, corporations are these transnational global entities, right? And then the internet and angry people who don't have nations can organize themselves across national boundaries. They can do. Al-Qaeda is a transnational, and there are lots of people with very dark agendas. And sometimes, aren't we just going to be radically at odds with the other, right? Radically at odds. And it's either you or me. It's either, we are just at odds.
Yeah, but it's not the other. There's all these others. Well, there's Al-Qaeda, there's Fox News, there's lots of others.
I know, but I want to,
so how do we think about the possibilities of human beings, I would say even equally rational human beings, being so divided, so at odds with one another that they can't find a way of being
together. I actually think we're bound to be at odds with one another. I think conflict and strife is part of what it is to be in a social world with other human beings. I think the real question is, how do we cultivate our aggression, our hatred, our being at odds in such a way that we can continue to cohabit in this world rather than destroy? Because, I mean, to be at odds or even to feel hatred or even to feel destructive impulse is not the same as acting on it, and it's not the same as waging war.
I agree. But that's not just a question for, say, us as liberal progressive Americans who want to stop aggression. You know, Osama bin Laden's here. We want to have a conversation with him. Okay, you can be at odds with us, but how do we have that conversation?
No, look, there are ways of it's not a question of having a conversation or having a war. I mean,
I agree.
There are many very forceful modes of resistance, like strikes, like embargoes, like, you know, there are ways of severing diplomatic ties. There are ways of trying to reach populations through underground media. There are many things to do when you're in a very stark oppositional situation.
Right. So it's not that you think, I just wanted to get that. It's not that you think that if we merely recognize the other as a full human, then all discord and division will go away and we'll reach Nietzsche's quote, hollow place of peace.
No, we need a political artistry of discord to be truly Nietzschean.
Yeah.
I hate to be sound pessimistic, but the most destructive war in America's history is still the Civil War. And in the Civil War, you had people from both sides who had worked together for years and years and years in the Congress, who respected and admired each other, what often related to each other, and they still couldn't pull it off. They still couldn't avoid this horrible, terrible war. There's something about the thing that is just, it's unbelievable.
Why don't you give us your closing thought?
No, it's true. I mean, well, this is what I found, at least in talking, say, to Israelis who really thought civilian casualties in Gaza were fine, or talking to American supporters of the war who thought Iraqi civilian casualties were fine. The belief is that the Iraqi civilian or the Palestinian civilian in both cases would turn around and kill you first if you did not kill them, so that the whole person, the whole other, as you put it, comes to represent a murderous impulse against oneself, right? So I either murder that one who will murder me first, luckily, or I become subject to that murder. And I think that's a mindset that we have to get out of.
Yeah, well, on that note, which I share with you, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been an enlightening conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Judith Butler. She's a professor of rhetoric and comparative literature at UC Berkeley, author most recently of Frames of War, When is Life Grievable?
And we also want to thank every single one in our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
So, John, this is a weighty topic. I mean, you've got any weighty final thoughts on this weighty topic?
Well, you know, the way I look at it, when two analytic philosophers from Stanford and a professor of rhetoric and comparative literature from Berkeley can sit down and have a civil conversation for an hour with no outbreaks of violence, in spite of the gender differences, there must be hope for the world. So that's my final thought.
Well, that's a nice final thought. I have my darkest moments, and maybe it's a thing of advancing age, I get deeply pessimistic about humanity. Because I don't think, and I guess Judith agrees with this, when I was younger, I thought, if you could just see the other as a fellow human being, all discord and division would go away. But I no longer believe that. So it's not merely a matter of achieving recognition of the other. It's a matter of concrete political organization and social and cultural organizations. And do we have the wisdom to bring that about? I just don't know. But, you know, like I said, maybe it's my advancing age that brings with it pessimism. But this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
But you can now download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word, we turn to a man who sacrifices it all for speed, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I attended a Macy's one-day sale the Friday following 9/11. I figured some new clothes might help in my quest for work, which I had not had for months. I was the only person in the men's department. Patriotic music was blaring over the loudspeakers. As my clerk totted up my meager purchase, a pair of khaki trousers, I glanced up to see another clerk on the other side of the store stomping half-heartedly and alone around his cash register to the beat of the piped-in John Philip Sousa march. In the 24 hours following 9/11, Walmart sold between 160,000 and 200,000 flags. America also went out and bought flag decals, flag refrigerator magnets, flaggy rubber ducks and bubble bath bottles, keychains, cup cozies, pens, stickers, address labels, temporary tattoos, beach balls, tote bags, and caps, among other items. Then, thanks to the anthrax attacks, roughly a week after 9/11, we experienced one more shopping flurry in which we purchased duct tape, bottled water, and Cipro. Remember Cipro? Ah, those were the days. And then we all hunkered back down in our hovels. That's probably why on September 27th, 2001, President Bush urged us to get on the airplanes, get about the business of America, get down to Disney World in Florida, take your families and enjoy life the way you want it to be enjoyed. Perhaps in response, on October 9th, 2001, San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown organized a rally at Civic Center Plaza, the purpose of which was to get Americans, and San Franciscans in particular, to get behind America by shopping. He had volunteers hand out posters that said, America, open for business, and shopping bags emblazoned with the flag. The U.S. Air Force Band provided music for the event, opening with Amazing Grace, not a tune I normally associate with bargain hunting. I did not attend the rally. Instead, I headed down foggy Irving Street in San Francisco's Sunset District a block from my house, where every shop had one of the America Open for Business signs in the window. I purchased a cold six-pack as part of my contribution to the War on Terror and was given a flag sticker absolutely free. The streets were thick with flags, but rather devoid of people. Clutching my beer and flag, I paused in front of an America Open for Business sign hanging in the window of the only bookstore in the neighborhood, which had gone out of business the summer before. I was not among them, but some of us did bravely leave our homes to get on the airlines, per the president's suggestion, until December 2001, that is, when one Richard Reed boarded a flight from Paris to Miami and tried to blow it up with his footwear, thus leading to the shoe removal ritual which all boarding passengers enjoy today. I would venture to suggest that the events of 9/11 left a gaping hole in our hearts, which we were urged to fill with products and travel. We weren't asked to fill that hole with victory gardens, with gasoline rationing, or even with simple grief. I tried to fill my particular hole with a nice pair of pants. They did not manage to fill the hole, but I did look very nice, I must say, when I finally left the house to declare bankruptcy. And today all of America joins me as we stagger forward, insolvent but unbowed, into our perhaps better, but certainly more expensive, tomorrow. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Stephanie Weissman, Patty Meyer, Arnie Warshaw, and Kedar Lawrence. Also thanks to Isaac Weiser, Rena Palta, Merle Kessler, Jennifer Jensen, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein and Cole Leahy are our directors of research. Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Stanford Humanities Center, various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our underfunders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.